All right, good evening. Tuesday night Bible study on the book of Acts. We're going to try and finish up the Tuesday night class tonight because of schedule issues the next couple of weeks. So we're going to do chapters 27 and 28. I'll kind of go through them a little bit quicker than I will on Wednesday because Wednesday will take a couple of weeks to finish this up. So if you remember, Paul was before Felix in Caesarea. He was before Festus and kind of languishing under house arrest under Festus for 2 years. Festus retires. He's replaced by Felix. And Felix says, what's going on with this? And he calls the Jews, and the Jews come, and they say, we want you to send Paul to Jerusalem so we can put him on trial. And Felix looks at Paul and says, is that acceptable? And Paul says, no, I appeal to Caesar. And after that, King Herod Agrippa comes and visits, just as a neighborly visit, because he's the tetrarch over Galilee. And he comes and visits, and Felix asks for his input. Paul defends himself, explains his conversion, explains the situation, that he's done nothing wrong, and Agrippa recognizes that. He says, yeah, you're right. If you hadn't appealed to Caesar, you should be let go. But he appealed to Caesar. So that's where chapter 26 ended. Any questions about that or lingering thoughts? Okay, so chapter 27. And when it was decided that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. So first of all, I was curious. It's called Italy. I looked it up in my Greek New Testament. And in Greek it says Italia. So I guess Italy is an ancient name going back to biblical times. I did not think that. I thought they might have called it something different back then. But they didn't. Notice there's some other prisoners. And we will come to find out Paul has some companions who are traveling with him just because he's in company on the journey. And so there's a centurion in charge named Julius. Does that mean he has all 100 of his Roman soldiers with him? Probably not. Probably takes a select dozen or two dozen or something and leaves the rest behind. So he's in charge of Paul and the other prisoners. Verse 2, and embarking in a ship from Adramyttium, which was about to sail to the ports along the coast of Asia, we put to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica. So Aristarchus is one of the companions of Paul. And he is a Christian, a believer, a convert from the church in Thessalonica. We heard his name because he accompanied Paul from Thessalonica with the offering for the Christians in Jerusalem. Okay? So we've heard his name before. Notice also what it says in here. We. When it was decided that we should sail for Italy. So that means Luke is still with him. Luke is with him. Luke has been with him for part of the trip and not part of the time of Acts and not part of the time for Acts. You can tell by the pronouns. Okay? So, if you look on your map, there's the one map from the Lutheran Study Bible. And you can see it shows setting sail from Maritima and going to Sidon. So that's the next verse. You'll see that on both sides, the other side of the map, which is a little bit more detailed. So verse 3, the next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go to his friends and be cared for. So that's a one-day sail. In case you're wondering on timing, 1 day to sail from Maritima to Sidon. You can see it on the map how far that is. Okay? Why'd they put in Sidon? It doesn't say. Maybe just to pick up more cargo. Who knows? But Julius, the centurion, is treating Paul kindly. So that's good. I don't know if the other prisoners were Roman citizens or not. No one knows. But at least Paul was, and he was being treated fairly by the centurion. Verse 4, and putting out to sea from there, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus, because the winds were against us. And when we had sailed across the open sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy and put us on board. So again, you can see the lee of Cyprus is the downwind part. So the winds are coming from the northwest. That's the general weather pattern. Same is true for us here in America, right? So they're sailing behind Cyprus for a while just to protect them from the winds, and then it's tougher going along the coast there of Pamphylia until they put it at Myra. And a ship from Alexandria, well, Alexandria is in Egypt, and it's sailing to Italy. Why is it up in Myra? That's kind of the wrong direction, but maybe it was dropping off or picking up cargo. Most of the shipping was cargo. It wasn't like going on a cruise back then. It's like, oh, let's go on vacation. We'll go on a cruise. No, you didn't do that. The vast majority of the shipping was cargo, and the balance of the shipping was moving soldiers or military. That was it. So they're in Myra. They pick up a ship. The centurion makes arrangements for a ship from Alexandria that's heading to Italy and put us on board. Verse 7. We sailed slowly for a number of days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus. And as the wind did not allow us to go further, we sailed under the lee of Crete off Salamis. Coasting along it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lasea. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of names. You can see on the one map, they went to Cnidus. They arrived there and then made dock there for at least a brief time and then went behind Crete in order to try and stay away from the winds. And we're going to find out, this is kind of the end of the sailing season. They generally did not sail from like November-ish till March because the weather was bad. Okay, and it made for very tough sailing. They didn't have ice like we do on the Great Lakes, but there were a lot of winter storms. And that would be the rainy season throughout the Mediterranean. So they needed the rain for irrigation and for drinking. They would store it up in cisterns. And also, generally, like in the Holy Land in Israel, planting season is like December to January, because then it immediately gets rained on during the rainy season, and it starts to grow when it gets halfway grown, and then they have to start watering it by hand after that, for it to finish growing and come to harvest, and they would harvest then in June-ish, versus like here, most of our harvesting is August, September. So it's the rainy season. So they're right near the end of the season where sailing is considered acceptable or safe. So you see, now I'm looking on the flip side map, the one that's more detailed. Then from Cnidus, they go behind Crete, behind Salamis, and they land at Fair Havens. Okay? So, let's see what's going on there. Since much time had passed, and the voyage was now dangerous because even the fast was already over. What's the fast referring to? That's referring to the Day of Atonement, right there in the footnotes, the Day of Atonement. The Day of Atonement is the end of September. The date varies slightly, but it's the end of September. So that means this is October. So it's really only considered safe to sail for another few weeks. Once you hit November, you don't sail. Isn't November when the Edmund Fitzgerald went down? Yeah, so see, even here in the Great Lakes, November starts to be sketchy sailing weather, and then all sailing stops, even on the Great Lakes. Now, in our case, it's because of ice. But in their case, it's just because of storms and waves. So that gives us a timing right there. Now, remember when Paul arrived in Jerusalem, it was Pentecost, but there was a two-year interval, so the timing has changed. But so this is the middle to the end of the autumn or fall. So it was already over. Paul advised them, verse 10, saying, "Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." Now why would Paul say that? He doesn't say he got a dream or a vision from God, because he has had that before. He's going to have another one later in the chapter. Maybe it's just that Paul is a respected prisoner. He's very educated. He's well-spoken. So he just says, you know, look, we've had trouble just getting this far. The winds are against us. You know, maybe we shouldn't go any farther. Verse 11, "But the centurion paid more attention to the pilot and to the owner of the ship than to what Paul said." Well, if I were the centurion, I would too. I'm like, he's the owner of the ship? And over there's the captain. They know better about sailing and stuff than you do, Paul. I'm not going to listen to you. So Paul must have been talking to the centurion, which would be appropriate. That's his, you know, his guard.
I think it's interesting, though, the footnote says, most likely Paul is offering advice based on his experience as a seasoned traveler. He had already endured 3 shipwrecks.
Yeah. So he's not a sailor, but he's got some experience traveling and probably recognizes the weather, right? So consider this more kind of like, a passenger on the voyage expressing concern about going any further. So the centurion ignores him in verse 12, and because the harbor was not suitable to spend the winter in, the majority decided to put out to sea from there on the chance that somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing both southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. So this is important. So look at your map. See Crete. And see, on the map from the Lutheran Study Bible, it doesn't show Phoenix. But on the other one, on the flip side, you can see there's Fair Havens and there's Phoenix. They're not far apart.
That's 100 kilometers.
100 kilometers. So if you look at the length there versus the length from Maritima to Sidon, it's like a one-day sail. And so they're thinking, Fair Havens is not a good place to winter. So they'd have to hunker down for 3 months or so for the winter. That's what they would expect. So he said, let's just go another day. We know there's a good port there. And then we'll stay there for the winter and then continue on. So they had a good plan. That's a good plan. All right. And then they would all hang out there for a little while. All right. So let's continue on. Verse 13. Now when the south wind blew gently, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete close to the shore. Sounds like a pretty wise thing to do for a bunch of seasoned sailors and a captain and the owner of the boat. Okay? So a south wind is favorable to them. It's not from the storms that come from the northwest. And also it would allow them, they could set their sails and just sail along the coast. So no problem. But verse 14. But soon a tempestuous wind called the Northeasters, we say here in America, right, or in the New England area, struck down from the land. And when the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along. So what happened? In one day's time, the wind changed from a favorable southerly wind to a northeastern wind that's coming down from the land. Crete is mountainous, so it's coming down from the mountains. And what is it doing? It's driving them out. They can't stay close to land. I mean, it's just a kind of common sense. There's nothing you can do about it. So, running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, we managed with difficulty to secure the ship's boat. So first of all, on the more detailed map, you see Cauda there. Here it says Cauda. There's a misspelling one way or another. If you look at the footnote, some manuscripts say Cauda, some say Cauda. So probably Cauda is the correct one. So they go around behind Cauda to try and get away from the wind a little bit. And they secure the ship's boat. Now, I don't know what that meant, so I looked at the footnotes, and it says in the Lutheran Study Bible that they generally would have a small boat, at both as a lifeboat and also as a transport boat. So if you're in port, you can transport passengers to shore and back. So a little rowboat. They would usually tow it behind or just attach it with a rope, and it would follow along behind. Well, because of this sudden windstorm that's come upon them, they secure it. So they haul it in and lash it up to the side of the boat or onto the edge of the boat or however they would do that. So they secure the ship's boat. Verse 17, after hoisting it up, they used supports to undergird the ship. Then, fearing that they would run aground on the Syrtis, they lowered the gear, and thus they were driven along. So use supports to undergird the ship. So here, again, just reading a little bit, they would take ropes, and you would hold on both ends, long ropes, drop it over the front of the bow, it would go under the ship, And you do that in at least three spots, one near the aft, one in the middle, one in the fore, and you wrap it around and then you tie it together, you pull it together as tight as you can and tie it, you know, one of those sailor knots or something, and that would help prevent the hull from cracking apart in rough weather. Kind of an old-fashioned but smart thing to do. Fortunately, I don't think our Navy has to do that anymore.
They have duct tape.
They use duct tape. That's right. But it has to be silver colored duct tape, right? Not any of those colored ones. Yeah. So they would have ropes available to do this in rough weather to help keep the boat from cracking apart. Okay. So they undergird the ship. Then fearing they would run aground on the Syrtis, they lowered the gear. So the Syrtis, do you see on the more detailed map, there's Syrtis Major and Syrtis Minor. See those? One's in the center left and one's near the bottom. Those are major sandbars in the Mediterranean Sea, upon which sailors knew they were there, but they didn't know precisely their depth and location, which would vary based on currents and things. But they would stay away from those areas because a ship could run aground on those. And then you'd be stuck for a while until the tide would come in or go out, or hopefully your ship wouldn't break apart. So they're fearful of that. You see on this more detailed map, there's a squiggly line there, because they don't really know where they are. They're being pushed along by the wind, and it says they lowered their gear. So I know in the ESV version here it says that is the sea anchor or possibly the mainsail. I looked up that word because the ESV doesn't, it says it's either the anchor or the mainsail. Well, that's a big difference. So I looked up the word in the Greek Bible, and the word there is equipment. They lowered their equipment. Well, what does that mean? Hence the confusion by the ESV translators. Personally, I would say it's the mainsail. Why would they lower the anchor? I could see that might be a possibility if they're trying to slow themselves down from being blown around. So you'd put out a sea anchor, which isn't dragging on the bottom, but it's just kind of giving you some stability. However, to me it makes more sense that they lowered the sails so that they're not getting blown about and tossed about. Really, it could be either. We don't know. Okay? So where were we? Verse 17. Fearful of the Syrtis, they lowered the gear, and thus they were driven along. So they're just getting pushed around by the wind. They don't know where they are precisely. Verse 18, since we were violently storm-tossed, they began the next day to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. Well, that's a problem. That's pretty serious. That tells you it's a pretty scary storm that they're in the midst of now. Okay, you throw your actual tackle overboard, you might need that. Okay, verse 20. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope of our being saved was at last abandoned. They're giving up hope. The sailors are, at least. They can't see the stars. They know the stars very well, not just the captain, but all the sailors, because that's how they navigate, right? We know that from ancient times. They can't see the stars, the storm is still about them, they're being tossed to and fro, they really don't know exactly where they are. Somewhere out there in the middle of the Mediterranean, being tossed about. Verse 21, since they had been without food for a long time, Paul stood up among them and said, now why would they be without food?
They threw it overboard.
Well, that's part of it, but you're about to see, they didn't throw it all overboard, they still have... I think they still have some wheat.
They only thought they were going 100 kilometers.
Yeah. I think, now this is just me speculating. I didn't find anything in any commentaries as to why they had been without food. I think they didn't eat because of the storm and seasickness. And they didn't want to get sick. Have any of you ever been seasick? I have. Well, you were in the Army, not the Navy, right, Chuck?
Mm-hmm.
But you've still been seasick out there in Lake Michigan, maybe?
Lake St. Clair.
Oh, Lake St. Clair?
Yeah, Lake Erie.
Wow. Yeah. I was seasick one time. I was helping a friend. He was sailing his boat from Port Huron up to Mackinac. and he needed two extra hands to sail this boat. And his wife and kids were driving up to Mackinac, and then they were going to leisurely sail back, stopping at all of the ports and the parks that Michigan has along the coast. So they'd sail a little bit and stop for a few days and sail a little bit. We were sailing straight up there, right up Lake Huron. And then we would take their car and bring it back. So it was me and another co-worker were helping him sail his boat. And the water got so rough. We were out in lake. This is summer. But a storm came through. And boy, was I seasick for a day or so. And you get off the boat and you still feel like everything's moving, right? Some of you have been there. Oh, it's an awful feeling. You can't eat a thing. I think that's what's going on here. No, that's just me speculating. Paul stood up among them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me and not have set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss." So there's Paul's little zinger, "I told you so." I guess, you know, even Paul can't resist a little "I told you so" moment. I don't think that's right in this moment. He shouldn't have said that. That's just my opinion. Don't ever do that to your spouse or a friend. "I told you so." People don't like hearing that. But there's Paul's little "I told you so" moment. Then he changes. Okay, so verse 22. "Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night there stood before me an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I worship. And he said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who sail with you.'" So Paul, in the middle of the night, must have had either a dream or a vision during the night, and an angel told him, "Paul, you and everybody on the boat will live, but the boat's going to be lost." So Paul knows they're going to have a problem, but he's confident. Paul is a man of strong faith at this point, right? He's been through an awful lot. So he sees this vision or this dream, whichever it is, and he tells them, "Look, it's going to be okay. We're all going to be okay. My God has told me so." Verse 25. "So take heart, men, for I have faith in God that will be exactly as I have been told, but we must run aground on some island." Okay? Well, the sailors at this point are thinking, "What kind of a crackpot are you? Mm-hmm. And who is this God that you worship, that you claim you know the situation?" You know, they're probably skeptical. "When the 14th night had come, as we were being driven across the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors suspected that they were nearing land. So they took a sounding and found 20 fathoms. A little farther on, they took a sounding again and found 15 fathoms." How deep is that? A fathom is about 6 feet or 2 meters. So about 120 feet, and it goes down to about 90 feet. Okay? So how would they take a fathom? You have a weight on the end of a rope and you drop it till it hits bottom, and you know how deep it is. Well, what is this indicating? Why is this important? It shows they're getting near land, but it also shows that they might have trouble in getting beached somewhere or stuck on a sandbar kind of thing. So it's important for them to know that. "Fearing," verse 29, "fearing that we might run on the rocks, they let down 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come." Who were they praying to? Probably their pagan gods. "As the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship and had lowered the ship's boat into the sea under pretense of laying out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, 'Unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved.' Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go." Ooh, that's pretty perceptive of Paul to say they're trying to escape. They claim they're just going to go put out more anchors from the bow because they let some anchors out from the stern. But that's not actually what they're going to do. So he warned the centurion, "If they abandon us, we're all lost." So what do the soldiers do? Cut the ropes to the boat. Now, would that make the sailors mad? Now the sailors are mad at the Roman soldiers who are on their boat. Right? So there's going to be some animosity there, no doubt.
It's interesting how they're now listening to Paul.
Yes, right. The sailors aren't listening to Paul. He said, "We're all going to be okay." The sailors don't believe him, and they want to escape from the rest of them. It almost kind of reminds you about like with Jonah. And when Jonah was sailing the wrong way and the storm hit him, right? Alright, so the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it go. As day was about to dawn, Paul urged them all to take some food, saying, "Today is the 14th day that you have continued in suspense and without food, having taken nothing. Therefore I urge you to take some food, for it will give you strength. For not a hair is to perish from the head of any of you." Again, he's reinforcing there that my God told me that we will all live. And when he had said these things, he took bread, and giving thanks to God in the presence of all, he broke it and began to eat. Then they all were encouraged and ate some food themselves. So they had bread. We're about to find out that they had wheat. Wheat must have been one of their cargoes. So they had wheat and they used some to make bread real quickly. Probably real quick unleavened bread kind of thing. So now this is the second time Paul mentions his God. So he's already planted some seeds here to talk to them about the true God. So in the midst of this, he's still planting a little thoughts about the gospel message. Okay? Verse 37. "We were in all 276 persons in the ship." Well, 276 persons. What's this footnote say? It says some manuscripts 76 or about 76. I happen to think that's correct. Again, I looked this up in my Greek New Testament, and the word there, let's see, did I put it in my notes? Diakosoi means twice 100. So it says diakosoi, and then it has the number for 76. So twice 100, 76. However, dia, so that's the prefix of that word I just told you, without the rest of the word, kosoi. If it's just dia, dia means around 76. To me, that makes sense. A shipping, a cargo ship like this is not going to hold 276 people. Could it hold 76 people plus cargo? Yes. If you think about ships from ancient times, from biblical times. So my suspicion is, and it's kind of acknowledged in the footnotes that it might be wrong. Some manuscripts, ancient manuscripts say dia 76 and some say diakosoi 76. Well, there must have been a flaw from some scribe who was creating it. So personally, I think it really should be around 76 persons. We were in all around 76 persons in the ship. And when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship, throwing out the wheat into the sea. Is wheat pretty heavy? I think it's a bit heavy, isn't it? You got big sacks of wheat? I don't know how heavy that would be.
Probably 50 or 100
pounds each. Yeah, probably. So they all had something to eat. They hadn't eaten for a while, because my opinion, seasickness, but who knows. So they all eat something, then they throw the rest of the cargo overboard. Now when it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they noticed a bay with a beach on which they planned, if possible, to run the ship ashore. So they cast off the anchors and left them in the sea, at the same time loosened the ropes that tied the rudders. Then hoisting the foresail to the wind, they made for the beach. But striking a reef, they ran the vessel aground. The bow struck and remained immovable, and the stern was being broken up by the surf. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wishing to save Paul, kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and make for the land, and the rest on planks or on pieces of the ship. And so it was that all were brought safely to land. Quite a story there, huh? Boy, I don't know if you ever realized, but I hadn't before teaching this class, how these last five or six chapters of Acts are just like one continuous story, right? I called it a soap opera, which it sort of is, but it's one continuous story here. So, Paul's message from the angel is correct. They all made it safely to land. The day arises, they know the depth of the water is getting shallower, so they must be near land. The day arises and they see land, and they say, oh, there's a beach over there, let's head for that beach. And before they can even get there, they run aground on a reef, and it starts breaking apart the ship. So now they got to swim for it. Most of them, I'm sure, could swim. Sailors, I would think, could swim. And the rest are trying to float on planks. Okay? All right. End of that chapter. Questions or comments? Like I said, I'm going to zip along because we're going to finish this tonight. I will take two nights. So, Chuck, if you come back on Wednesday, you don't need to come back on Wednesday because you're hearing it all tonight in fast, in quick step. All right. So let's give me another half hour. We'll finish chapter 28 and we'll be done for Tuesday night. So, chapter 28. And the story continues. To be continued.
Cliffhanger.
Didn't you hate that when that would happen? To be continued. I always hated that, to be continued. Especially when some show would do that on the season finale, to be continued, and then you gotta wait till next fall for the next season to start to hear the rest of the story. That annoyed me. Of course they did that on purpose to draw you back to their show. Well, to be continued. Here we are. Verse 28. And after we were brought, or chapter 28, sorry, chapter 28 verse 1. And after we were brought safely through, we then learned that the island was called Malta. Again, that's still the same name today. So look at your map one more time. There's Malta. Do you see it? So that's where they ended up running aground. Now I was curious, I've heard of Malta, but I didn't know much about it. So I did a quick search of Malta. Malta is an independent country today. It's about 120 square miles. So not that big. Population is about 500,000. So not that populous. However, and I did notice, just in case you're curious, because I'm curious, their primary economy is shipping and tourism. So they are a port in the middle of the Mediterranean, and you can kind of see where they are. They really are in the middle of the Mediterranean. So they take ships in and off, and they offload and transfer to new ships, and it's a shipping port. And the pictures that I saw on Wikipedia, gorgeous. It's like Greek islands with, you know, gorgeous sandy beaches. So their economy is basically tourism and shipping. It did say that they have to get almost all of their fresh water and their food shipped to them because it's a relatively small-ish island, 120 square miles. Think about it, that's like 10 by 12 miles, 10 miles by 12 miles, not that big. So, but it's a city today, it's a country today. So, Chuck.
Very strategic port during the Second World War.
Was it? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm a kind of a war buff as well, and it seems it did play a part in some of the Mediterranean battles, like the British coming across from, British and Americans coming across from North Africa, trying to invade Italy. Did they stop at Malta?
Well, or they had to? It was under control of the Allies the whole time.
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
So that
quite a beating.
Yeah, oh, from the Germans. The Germans were trying to get the Allies off of Malta because that would give them an air base, right?
An air base and a port.
Yeah. Okay. So it's very strategic. Absolutely. Well, Paul was there. I hope during World War II when they bombed it, they didn't bomb the places Paul was, so we could still go there and visit. Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure that's been long destroyed. Wherever Paul was, that's been long destroyed. All right. Verse 2. The native people showed us unusual kindness, for they kindled a fire and welcomed us all because it had begun to rain and was cold. Well, that's nice. They did show them kindness. When Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and put them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. When the native people saw the creature hanging from his hand, they said to one another, "No doubt this man is a murderer. Though he has escaped from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live." Now, in the ESV, they capitalized justice, but I don't think it, I mean, it could be. What does it say? Yeah, or the footnote says, or justice without a capital J. So justice. The word there is justice. So another one I looked up, justice. So was justice a name for maybe one of their pagan gods? I don't know. I don't know what kind of pagan religion they had on the island. However, it could just be that they're saying like fate. I think of this as them saying like, well, this particular guy escaped from that shipwreck. We saw them shipwrecked out there, and they all swam ashore. Most, you know, He escaped from that, but now fate has him bitten by a poisonous snake, so obviously he's a murderer, and the fate is taking him down, is going to give him his punishment. That's how I interpret this, as justice, with a small j, justice, or fate.
Footnote on this?
Yeah.
Says, among the Greek gods and goddesses, justice was the daughter of Zeus, who extracted revenge on humans. However, the natives might possibly be speaking of justice in the general sense of the word.
Mm-hmm. So could they have been talking of, so there is a Greek god named Justice. Okay, so it could be the god, or it could be just they were referring to fate. Either way. Okay, verse 5. He, however, shook off the creature into the fire and suffered no harm. That is a little bit of amazing. Okay, so it's a poisonous snake. So either Paul has some miraculous anti-venom within his blood or within his system, or the snake didn't bite through or break skin or something. God protected Paul, clearly. So it's a minor miracle here. They were waiting for him to swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But when they had waited a long time and saw no misfortune come to him, they changed their minds and said that he was a god. Now, this has happened a couple of times with Paul, hasn't it? He's already got experience with this. Now, what did he do in the previous occasions? He said, no, I'm not a god, but let me tell you about God, the true God, right? Now, we don't hear about that here, because we look at the next one, verse 7, now in the neighborhood of that place were lands belonging to the chief man of the island, named Publius, who received us and entertained us hospitably for 3 days. So it doesn't say that Paul corrected them, but I think it's safe to say Paul corrected them. He would have said, no, I'm not a god. Don't worship me. But by the way, let me tell you about the true God. And then he would have preached the gospel. Well, anyway, all of this takes place on that first day when they come ashore. And now the chief man of the island, so these are hospitable people. They welcome in strangers. That's a good thing. That's a good quality to have. Verse 8, it happened that the father of Publius lay sick with fever and dysentery. And Paul visited him and prayed, and putting his hands on him, healed him. Paul has healed a lot of people, hasn't he? So he's still doing miracles. Miracles are still prevalent in this early phase of Christianity, this early history of Christianity. So Paul prays, puts his hands on him. Well, when he prays, he's praying out loud, and so they're hearing him pray to Jesus and to God, the Father, Yahweh. So they're hearing all this. So again, here's another dose of gospel preaching through this prayer and this healing. Verse 9, and when this had taken place, the rest of the people on the island who had diseases also came and were cured. Didn't that happen with Jesus? He'd go into town and into a village, he'd go there to preach, and he'd heal somebody, and then what would they do? They'd bring everybody else who was sick. Well, yeah, that's an obvious logical sense. I would do that too. And oh, by the way, Jesus, here's somebody with a fever, and here's somebody who's sick, and we don't know what's wrong, and here's somebody else who's lame, and Jesus, I got this ingrown toenail. Can you fix that for me too? Who knows? Diseases great and small. Well, Paul's doing that here. So he cures more of them. Verse 10, they also honored us greatly. And when we were about to sail, they put on board whatever we needed. So they outfitted them, you know, with all their supplies that they need. Well, where'd they get another ship from? Malta's in the shipping lanes. So probably another ship comes. And this is what you have to read the next verse to figure this out. After 3 months, we set sail in a ship that had wintered in the island, a ship of Alexandria with the twin gods as figurehead. So, they were there for 3 months. This is where they wintered. Okay, so they lived among these very hospitable natives, and there is a port there, because there's another ship from Alexandria that stayed there for 3 months waiting for the winter storms to pass. And the centurion, he must still have money on him, the centurion buys passage for him, his soldiers, and his prisoners, and they get on this ship of Alexandria. Twin gods as figurehead. So there is, in Greek mythology, a pair of gods that were twins, a brother and a sister. I don't remember their names. It probably says it in the footnotes, but it doesn't really matter. So this boat is sailing under those twin gods of Greek mythology.
Castor and Pollux.
Castor and Pollux? All right, very good. Did you know that, or did you have to look it up?
I know of them, but yeah, I didn't know that's who it was referring to.
Okay. Very good. Pollux. That was a name that was in Mockingjay or Hunger Games. I wonder if there was any connection. Sorry. I'm into science fiction movies too, so anyway. All right, verse 12. Putting in at Syracuse, we stayed there for 3 days, and from there we made a circuit and arrived at Rhegium. And after 1 day, a south wind sprang up, and on the second day we came to Puteoli. So there's some more places. The last time you really need to look at the map, you look at the map, they use Malta, and if you look at the distance and compare it, you see Maritima to Sidon is 1 day sail. So Malta to Syracuse would be 1 day, Syracuse to Rhegium would be 1 day, and then Rhegium to Puteoli would probably be 2 or 3 days. You kind of see it on the map there. So they're making their way into Italy, which is where this cargo ship from Alexandria was heading anyway. So they bought passage on that ship. So they land in Puteoli, verse 14. There we found brothers, and were invited to stay with them for 7 days, and so we came to Rome. So, brothers, obviously that's a reference to fellow Christians. So the word had gotten there. Paul had not been there yet. We know that none of the other apostles had gotten there yet. So the message, the gospel message, had pre-traveled there in front of Paul. Now, some of you, I don't know if it was the Tuesday class or the Wednesday class, but I think it was last week, asked, since Paul's on his journey to Rome, when did he write the book of Romans? That's a good question. I didn't have the answer to. But it's important for this right here. So I looked it up. Paul wrote Romans in 55 A.D., and he references in the book of Romans at the end, staying with Erastus, who is the town treasurer, who gave him hospitality and allowed him to stay with him. Erastus was the town treasurer of Corinth. So, Paul wrote Romans, the book of Romans, from Corinth, which was right near the end of his third missionary journey. You remember he stayed in Corinth for a year and a half. And when he left Corinth, he began his journey back to Jerusalem. And that's when people began to tell him, I had a dream, don't go back to Jerusalem, they're going to arrest you. And Paul said, I have to go. So Paul wrote Romans right near the end of his third missionary journey as he started his return to Jerusalem. Okay, the dates right here of these events are like 59 and 60, 58, 59, and 60 A.D., So he put out, they started sailing for Rome in 58. They got there, we think, in 59. And then he's under house arrest there. You'll see that here in another paragraph or two. He's under house arrest there for a couple of years. And anyway, we'll finish that bit. So he wrote Romans approximately 3 years prior to this. So the gospel message had reached some people in Rome and had spread a little bit just from his letter, which became known to us as the book of Romans. Okay? Does that help tie that in? Questions? Comments? I haven't paused enough for questions. I'm trying to get through two chapters, so. Any questions or thoughts? Okay. So, verse 14, there in Puteoli, there we found brothers and were invited to stay with them for 7 days, and so we came to Rome. You will notice at the end on both maps, it shows that from Puteoli to Rome, they traveled overland. So they probably walked. Maybe the centurion rented some carts and they transported the prisoners, but more likely they walked. Okay, verse 15. And the brothers there, when they heard about us, came as far as the Forum of Appius and three taverns to meet us. Apparently those are some well-known places on the Appian Way, which went up the length of Italy. Appian Way was a major road system. So some believers from Rome come out to meet Paul and his companions as they're traveling into Rome. On seeing them, Paul thanked God and took courage. And when he had come into Rome, Paul was allowed to stay by himself with the soldier who guarded him. So he's put again under house arrest. Probably not as nice a digs as Herod's palace in Maritima. Okay? But he's under house arrest again, so he has some freedom. He's not in the jail cell, but he's got a constant Roman guard about him, which actually is probably good. Provides you some security. Except that he doesn't have the freedom to do or go where he wants. But he can still receive visitors. Okay? Everybody with me? Alright, we're streaming along. The wind is at our backs. We're letting it take us forward and finish the book of Acts. Alright, verse 17. After 3 days, he called together the local leaders of the Jews, and when they had gathered, he said to them, "Brothers, though I had done nothing against our people or the customs of our fathers, yet I was delivered as a prisoner from Jerusalem into the hands of the Romans. And when they had examined me, they wished to set me at liberty, because there was no reason for the death penalty in my case. But, pardon me. But because the Jews objected, I was compelled to appeal to Caesar, though I had no charge to bring against my nation. For this reason, therefore, I have asked to see you and speak with you, since it is because of the hope of Israel that I am wearing this chain." So, first question, why does he call the Jews together? It says at the beginning, he called the leaders of the Jews, the local leaders of the Jews, and they come to him. Paul's a very well-known, semi-famous in Jewish circles. Remember, he was a Pharisee of Pharisees. He studied under
Gamaliel.
Thank you, Gamaliel. I was about to say Galileo, and I knew that wasn't right. Gamaliel, yes. So the Jewish leaders come to him. Why does he call the Jews together? Well, what was Paul's typical mode of operation when he would go to a place? He would first start in the synagogue, right, and preach to the Jews. He did that in Thessalonica. He did that in Corinth. He did that in Philippi. He did that in a whole bunch of places. Usually he would get some converts from the Jews who would recognize that what Paul's preaching, that Jesus is the long-sought-for Messiah, and some Jews would be obstinate. Some would convert, some would be obstinate. So that's why he's calling again the Jews. Some of the Jews here have probably already read his letter that he sent, the book of Romans. Okay? So he calls them together, and he says, "Here's the situation. I haven't done anything, but some accused me, and so they turned me into the Romans, and I kind of had to object and appeal to Caesar just to get myself out of there, out of that situation." So that's what he says here. And because of the hope of Israel, there's a name for Jesus. The hope of Israel. Because what was the hope of Israel in the Old Testament? The coming Messiah. So Paul is preaching that the Messiah has come. His name is Jesus. He lived, he died, he rose again. And we need to recognize that, my fellow Jews. So that's what he's saying. That I'm wearing this chain. So obviously, even though he's under house arrest, he has some kind of chain on him. Bound by the wrists, bound by the ankles, I don't know. There's some speculation that when he would want to go out from the house, if he would on occasion, he would be chained to one of the Roman soldiers. You know, like wrist to wrist or something, you know, with some length in between or whatever. But so he had some kind of chain on him because he references that. It's the reason that I'm under guard by that soldier standing right there and that I have this chain on me because of the hope of Israel. Yeah, Jeannie?
Here it says that under certain circumstances, Roman practice allowed free access to the prisoner during the day, but enforced solitude through the night. And then it goes on to say that Josephus says that 8,000 Jews appeared against Archelaus in Rome. Modern estimates of the number of Jews at Rome in the first century range between 10,000 to 50,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
Quite a number of Jews.
So Paul could call them to him.
Right. During the day.
Right.
But at night he had to have solitude.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Verse 21. And they said to him, "We have received no letters from Judea about you, and none of the brothers coming here has reported or spoken any evil about you." So in this case, they're referring to brother Jews, not brother Christians, although some of the Jews would be Christians. Remember, there were some that were both, like Paul was. "So none of the brothers coming here has reported or spoken any evil about you. But we desire to hear from you what your views are. For with regard to this sect, we know that everywhere it is spoken against." So in Jewish circles, it's spoken against. This sect of Jesus. Okay? So that's what they're talking about. "Yeah, we want to hear more about it. Paul, we don't have any bad reports about you that have preceded you here. But we do want to hear about this. What is it you're talking about?" Okay. Verse 23. "When they had appointed a day for him, they came to him at his lodging in greater numbers." So there we are, like you said, Jeannie, they came to him in greater numbers, so more than just the leaders. "From morning till evening, he expounded to them, testifying to the kingdom of God and trying to convince them about Jesus, both from the law of Moses and from the prophets." So Paul's very learned in the Torah, the Old Testament, the Jewish writings, what we call the Old Testament. And he's pointing out to them every place, the law of Moses, so that'd be the first five books, and the prophets, that would be the rest. He's pointing out all of these prophecies that point to Jesus. He's making the connections for them. Verse 24, "And some were convinced by what he said, but others disbelieved. And disagreeing among themselves, they departed after Paul had made one statement." Okay, so first of all, what is the overall theme of Acts? Remember, Luke wrote the Gospel of Luke and the Book of Acts. So I'm going to tie this up right here. I said this at the beginning and a couple of times throughout the Bible study. Luke wrote the Gospel of Luke to say, what is the Gospel? The Gospel is Jesus and the news about him. Okay, the Gospel of Luke, like the other, all four Gospels, it's all about Jesus. The Book of Acts is, what does the Gospel do? The Gospel gets preached, and it causes some people to believe, and it causes some people to object and reject the Gospel. Okay, so it divides people. Some become Christians, and some become objectors, rejectors. Okay. So that's what's happening here. Some were convinced by what he said, but others disbelieved. So I would say that verse right there, verse 24, we're right near the end here. We only got another paragraph to go or so. That's the theme verse of Acts, if you ask me. It doesn't say this in any of the commentaries that I read, but I just, my thought as just one pastor is, Acts chapter 28, verse 24 is the theme for the entire book. Some were convinced and others disbelieved. That's what happens to the gospel message. We should not be surprised in this day and age when the gospel message is proclaimed even in our modern American culture and some people disbelieve it, reject it, have objections to what we say and start to persecute us or taunt us or make fun of us. That happens in American culture too, right? We shouldn't be surprised by that. On the other hand, when we proclaim the gospel, as a church or as Christianity, when we proclaim the gospel, some people do believe it. So some believe, and others make fun and reject and walk away. That happened back here for Paul, too. Okay? Right there's your theme verse. All right. "Disagreeing among themselves, they departed after Paul had made one statement, his final statement. The Holy Spirit was right in saying to your fathers, through Isaiah the prophet, go to this people and say, but you indeed hear, but never understand, and you will indeed see, but never perceive. For this people's heart has grown dull, and with their ears they can barely hear, and their eyes they have closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their heart, and turn, and I would heal them." Isaiah made that prophecy to the nation of Israel at a time when big chunks of the nation of Israel were becoming apostate. In other words, non-believers. Jews at the time of Isaiah were saying, what has Yahweh done for us? I don't, does he really exist? I'm not sure. They just became apathetic at the time of Isaiah. So Isaiah made this proclamation to them, to say, some of you have dulled your own hearts, so that even though you hear God's word, you don't understand it, you can't hear it, you don't care about it, you ignore it. So this was a warning from Isaiah to the people at his time who were becoming apathetic and apostate. Okay? Paul now applies this to the Jews, that just some believed him. Hooray! So some convert and become Christians. We don't know what percentage. And some disbelieve him. And Paul, you're off your rocker. We don't believe you. Jesus is not the Messiah we're looking for. So Paul applies this to them. Could we apply this to people today? Absolutely. Same thing, right? It still applies today. Some people just close their mind and they don't want to believe it. Even though they hear the message about Jesus, they don't want to believe it. Yeah, Jeannie?
Which chapter in Isaiah is that from? This Bible doesn't have any
notes. Oh, it doesn't say?
Isaiah 6, 9 through 11.
Thank you.
6 through 9, 10 is what the note is here.
There you go. Try that.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you, Celeste. I didn't have it handy in front of me. That's a good question, though. So here we are, very end. At the end of all things. Oh, a little Lord of the Rings quote for you. Therefore, let it be known to you that this salvation of God has been sent to the Gentiles. They will listen. Well, not all of them will listen. Same thing as with the Gentiles. Some will listen and some will not. So Paul is basically proclaiming here, this is appropriate. This is the last we hear of Paul. This is the end. Paul is basically proclaiming, I have preached to all the Jews, some believed, many did not. I have preached to the Gentiles, they will listen, although the truth is, some of them will not listen either. So Paul is kind of proclaiming here in verse 28, his obligation, his duty is done. That's what he's saying. Verse 30, he lived there 2 whole years at his own expense and welcomed all who came to him, proclaiming the kingdom of God and teaching about the Lord Jesus with all boldness and without hindrance. So he received visitors. Anybody who wanted to hear, he would talk to them. He would preach to them. He talked about Jesus while under house arrest for 2 more years. It is during that 2 years that Luke wrote this book of Acts. We know that that 2 years from early church fathers, so could be some slight variation, but on pretty good authority, that 2 years was A.D. 58 to 60. Paul was released by Caesar in 60. Then we have no knowledge of what happened to him other than some early church fathers claim that Paul fulfilled his dream of going to Spain. He went to Spain probably because he wanted to try paella, see what that was like, and then he returned. No, not. I'm joking, obviously. He says in some of his letters he would like to go to Spain. That was the end of the known world at that time. So Paul had preached throughout the known civilized world, from the middle of the Mediterranean to the eastern end of the Mediterranean. What, you know, from Rome, Greece, Turkey, Israel, Egypt, Persia, you know, he had preached in that realm. So he wanted to go to Spain. Some of the early church fathers claim that when Paul was released in 60 AD, he did go to Spain, but we have no proof of that. I personally think he probably did. He went there, he returned, and by the time he returned, Nero had changed. Remember I talked about that last week? So Nero originally was a decent Caesar, a decent emperor. He was doing some things that was popular with the people. Then he got full of himself, wanted to build a bigger palace. I told you this last week, I think, right? So there was a mysterious fire in the middle of Rome that cleared some land so he could build a palace. People got mad at Nero because they thought he started it, which historians think he did. And so he started blaming Christians, and then the Christian persecution began in earnest. Paul returned during that persecution. And we also know from early church fathers that Paul ended up being rearrested in Rome and beheaded in 68 AD. Okay? So that timing all fits. Now, those dates could be a year off, who knows, from history, but it seems to all fit. Okay? So this was written during that 2 years of his first imprisonment, house arrest in Rome, while he awaited an appeal to Caesar, from which we know in history he was eventually released for a little time and then rearrested. Okay? Questions or comments? There we go, about an hour and a quarter. So we're just about okay. Yes?
Was it the same centurion who stayed with him for 2 years in Rome, I wonder?
No idea.
Because it sounded like his heart was starting to be softened on the trip.
Yes! You're right, it did. Because at first the centurion said, I'm not going to listen to you, Paul. I'm listening to the captain and the owner of the ship. But then he started listening to Paul. So, I mean, if I were a centurion, I want to be put under house, I want to be assigned the duty of guarding this prisoner under house arrest, because it'd be pretty easy duty, right? Yeah. So, could he have started having his heart turned by the preaching of Paul? Yes, he might have. The answer is, I don't know. Nobody knows.
He would have also seen the miracles on the island, too.
He would have seen the miracles on the island, the healing miracles on Malta. So, yes, there's a lot of people in stories like in this story, in this event, that, you know, we'll probably see in heaven that we didn't know about. You know, we'll see some Roman soldier in heaven who's in all of his Roman armor. No, they won't be wearing their armor. And he'll say, oh, I was one of the soldiers that guarded Paul. Oh, really? What was that like? Well, I saw the miracles he did on Malta that really converted me. You know, I'm making this all up, of course, but who knows? We might see some of those Roman soldiers in heaven because they were converted by Paul. Glory be if they did, if they were. So, yeah, it's just interesting to kind of ponder, but we don't really know. All right, yeah, Jeannie.
I love the way this last part is in Philip's New Testament. So Paul stayed there with two full years in his own rented apartment. I thought of that line.
Yeah.
So my question is, did Luke go with him after this? Do we know anything
good
about
question.
Luke after this?
I don't know. You know, I'm sure somebody, maybe an early church historian who's read all of the writings of the early church fathers, there might be some indication from early church fathers what happened to Luke. I personally don't know what happened to Luke after this. Luke was with Paul for big chunks of these missionary journeys, and then he wrote this all down. Thanks to God that he did, because now we have these events. But after this point, Luke was pretty close friend with Paul, and a student of Paul's. You know, Paul was his mentor. So if Paul did in fact go to Spain, I would suspect Luke went with him.
Because he was Paul's physician, basically.
That's a good reminder. Luke was a physician, so he would be able to take care of Paul.
And some of the Greek words here, you know, that I skimmed through, it always says, and the medical meeting is.
Right.
Probably 10 times in these last 2 chapters.
Right, right.
Did Josephus write anything about Paul or Luke or any of
I don't
other
know.
Writers or apostles?
You know, I have a book of Josephus in my office, which I've never read. If I had time, I would probably read it because it would fill in some gaps. Yes, so I don't know. If you'd like to borrow my book of Josephus, I'll loan it to you. Yeah, there might be one over there in the church library, you're right. Yeah, Josephus apparently is quite a writer, Jewish historian of this very time frame. Yeah. All right, any other questions or comments?
He isn't considered an early church father.
No, because he wasn't a believer. Correct. He never professed to be a Christian. He was just an objective historian. Yeah. Yep. All right. Very good. Well, this is the end of our study on Acts. So remember, we have about a month off and because of Christmas stuff happening. And we'll meet again like the second week of January. Okay? All right. Let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive
us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good evening.
I'm going to go to surgery.